Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
What the hell's going on? Goo Goo Dolls, natural segue into talking about World War II, just in case you don't know. Email, Mac, has the world gone batshit? How do you idolize people who murder people? And how is this girl who's in high school not identified as somebody who has significant mental health issues? If there's ever an argument to arm yourself in this country, it's a number of events that we have like this. I bet when you begin to talk and develop the story on this, we're going to see the same shit that we've seen over and over. A young person troubled, a young person that's mused about this stuff, a young person that's kind of sort of made veiled threats. And yet nobody flags him. To quote you, their right to be free trumps our right to be safe. Getting pretty sickening. And that is a liberal view. Take away my gun and don't infringe on anybody's civil rights. Color me pissed. Yeah, I think I got that memo. And you know what? He's true. He's right about that stuff. All right. I want to play for you some audio. And you're going to hear from R.V. Bergen. Good. And his given name is Romus, R-O-M-U-S, Valtenbergen. You don't hear names like that anymore. He's born on August 13th, 1922. He passed away on April 6, 2019. He was born in Jewett, Texas, and he passed away in Lancaster, Texas. He is a soft-spoken Texan, but as tough as they come. Enlisted in the Marine Corps. I'll read you about him. His father's name was Joseph. His mother's name was Beulah May. His younger brother, Joe, joined the United States Army after changing his year of birth from 1926 to 1925 and was sent to Europe as a member of Company C, the 274th Infantry Regiment of the 70th Infantry Division. He died in the Alsace-Lorraine area on February 17, 1945, when he was killed by artillery fire near the River Saar in the town of Forbach as his unit moved east towards Starbrücken on the other side of the river as part of the push against the Siegfried Line. He was buried at the Sardis Cemetery next to his parents. Bergen joined the Marine Corps on November 13, 1942. He was assigned to the 9th Replacement Battalion. He became a mortarman in Kilo Company, known as King Company at the time, and Kilo after 1957, of the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines of the 1st Marine Division. He fought in Cape Gloucester, on Peleliu, and in Okinawa. He was promoted to the rank of sergeant upon reaching Okinawa. Now, I'm looking for a footnote. Right? A Library of Congress footnote. About when the book's published. Here's a link to the Today Show, which shows Donald Trump. So clearly not the right story. But anyway, yeah, it shows that, you know, the Pacific came out in 2010 and that his book came out in 2010. So I'm confused. So if you have any better information than I do, please don't be afraid. Book search. I'm looking at the Library of Congress thing. ISBN. International Standard Book Number. That's what that is. I just don't understand. And this is bugging me. In case you can't tell, this is bugging me. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his actions in the Battle of Okinawa. You'll hear him talk about that in a few minutes. When he destroyed a Japanese machine gun emplacement that had the company pinned down. He was also going to be awarded the Silver Star on Peleliu, but Haldane, the commanding officer of the company of Kilo Company, was killed by a sniper before he could submit the award. After the war, he went to work for the post office. He married a woman he met in Australia. Her name is Florence Risley. They had four daughters. She's portrayed by Martin McCann in the HBO miniseries, The Pacific. He himself appears in the documentary during the miniseries. But I can't tell you when it was published. Because I can't. It says 2010, but that doesn't make sense. Okay. Anyway, Matt, get over it. So you're going to hear from him, as he speaks. And there's not a long, interview with him that I can find anyway. And so here he is in his own words, something that I love to do, on this program.
We got aboard an Amtrak that morning and come out of the, when the vessel that we were on, LST or LCM, I guess it was, when it opened its doors and we hit the water and wallowed around out there like a buffalo and circled and drove around in circles until we got the word to go in.
I was talking about the landing on Peleliu, I believe.
And while we were doing that, the Navy, from daylight on that morning, we hit the beach shortly after 8 o'clock that morning, but by the time daylight got there, the bomber planes were bombing and strafing and shooting their rockets. The Navy was shooting rockets and 16-inch guns. All the big guns from the Navy was working it over. A lot of black smoke, gray smoke. A lot of fire on the beach. It looked like it was an island was on fire. And we were going in, and we got hung up on a reef. And Johnny Marmette pulled his .45 out and told that guy he'd kill him if he didn't get that Amtrak off that reef. And you could hear the track spinning and grinding and going on, and all of a sudden, I know it seemed to me like we was there for 2 or 3 minutes, but I'm sure it was just seconds that we were there. But we were setting target. I mean, you know, we were a setting target. And we had already, the Jap gun was already zeroing in on us. I know that for a fact. He was hit to the left or the right of us and over us and ahead of us. And just as we pulled out, after we got broke loose from that reef, just as we pulled out from that thing, we hadn't gone 10 yards until a shell landed right in front of us. And I mean close. It's flat, close enough to splatter water on you. And I think that kind of was a God thing. I think that if we hadn't hung up on that reef, we'd have walked right straight into that shell. And we'd have all been most likely done away with right there. Never made it into shore at all. But then we went on into the beach, and our motto was to get the hell off the beach. You know, don't stand around, don't jam it up, get off the beach. You're setting target. That's where they're zeroed in on you with their artillery and all big mortars. So get off the beach. So we did. We got up and got inland a little ways. And I never will forget it. Sledge didn't smoke, and I knew he didn't smoke. And we hadn't been on the beach, I don't guess, 20 minutes. And Sledge said to me, he said, "Bergen, you got a cigarette?" And I said, "Yeah." "But you don't smoke." "You don't smoke, Sledge." "Yeah, but I want a cigarette." I gave him a cigarette, and I looked around a few minutes later, and he chewed that rascal right down to nuts. He hadn't smoked it at all. He was really nervous. I was nervous enough, but he was really nervous. But rightfully so, too, because he was working us over pretty good. After we had that little banzai charge that afternoon, we moved back up on the hill about 300 yards.
Now he's talking about Cape Gloucester here.
And dug in up there for the night. And that was the longest night I think I ever spent, or pretty close to it anyway. The land crabs was crawling around and making racket, and you could just imagine the Japs was trying to sneak up on you. And it was a very nerve-wracking night for me. Of course, that was my first encounter with the Japs. So we made it through the night. One of the guys got out of the foxhole, and my sergeant shot him. Didn't kill him, but he wounded him. And that taught me a lesson right there and make sure that I didn't get out of a foxhole any time during the night. The Japs moved around a lot at night, so we had a policy that no Marine out of his foxhole at night. But the Japs didn't come through, so if anybody prowling around, you didn't ask questions, you just shot, and then holler, "Who's there?" if you hollered anything. Eugene Sledge came whenever we came back off of New Britain to Pavuvu. Sledge was there come in as a replacement.
All right, so they've left Cape Gloucester and they go to Pavuvu. This is a story of the 1st Marine Division that Bergen's a part of for his same unit the whole time he's there. So they leave Cape Gloucester and they go back to Pavuvu, but Pavuvu is like a dirt hole of an island when they get there, and he talks about it here now.
And he was assigned to my squad.
Now he's talking about Eugene Sledge showing up.
And I knew that he'd had a little bit of college, but he was just a green kid like I was whenever I first got there. And I never thought too much about him one way or the other as far as him where he was a good Marine or where he wasn't a good Marine. He went through all the training and everything that we went through. And then we went on into Peleliu, and whenever we hit Peleliu, well, Sledgeon always did what I told him to do or asked him to do and never hesitated. And you can't ask much more than that of a Marine, of a guy, your buddy. And I always admired Sledgeon for the simple reason.
Now, I found this really interesting, right? So Bergen is from Texas, right? Sledge is from Alabama. Sledge is the son of a doctor and comes from money. So listen to what Bergen says about why he respected Sledge so much.
That the way I understood it, his dad was a medical doctor, and they were pretty well off, I think. And so they had a yard boy, and they had a nanny, and a cook, and everything like that. And said his only responsibility was to feed his dog. And I thought the kid come out of an environment like that and come into the Marine Corps as strict as they are and as much physical training as you get and mental training, I thought he did real well. And I always admired him for that, sticking it out like he did. Well, from day one, whenever I joined the Marine Corps, they started telling us what the Japs had. Of course, I already knew that they'd bomb Pearl Harbor, and they would tell us stories about the Guadalcanal, what happened in the Guadalcanal, and so they gave you all of the information that they had, and I mean they added some to it too, to be truthful with you, but. Some of them, I think, that was telling the stories. I doubt if they'd ever been to Guadalcanal. But at the same time, they give us that and tell you what they were, how sadistic that they really were. So you went in hating them. In fact, the business, when I went into the Marine Corps, hit boot camp out in San Diego, I never had thought about killing anybody in my life. You know, I was just one of those types that never give that a thought. And we had 6 weeks of boot camp. By the time that I finished boot camp, I can honestly say that I could have cut a Jap's throat and never blinked an eye. And after I got over there and seen what was going on, I hated them more then than I'd ever hated them. And I guess as long as I breathe a breath, I'll hate the Jap soldier. You know, it's no way getting around it. And my wife said one time, said, "You keep calling them Japs. You think that's the proper thing to do this day and time?" I said, "I don't give a damn whether it's proper or not. To me, he's a damn Jap then, and he's still a damn Jap. I'm talking about the soldier himself." And I said, "As long as I live, that's what I'll call him. And as long as I live, I'll hate the SOB too." But I've been to Japan, and I don't hold any grudges against, you know, the Japanese people. But the Jap soldier, I hated him, and I still hate him.
And, you know, what's interesting is that was, you know, that was a common... I mean, you hear Gene Sledge talking. Now, Sledge is a PhD. And, right, he's an educated man. And I think people don't understand the experience when they expect you to talk about the barbarity that you experience and somehow or other sanitize that name. Right? So, Eugene Sledge, PhD, right, never refers to Japanese soldiers other than Japs. And Bergen, he's a plain-spoken Texas, gets out of the Marine Corps when he comes home, goes to work for the Postal Service, lives to be the age of 96 years old, and never calls him anything but Japs. And I think for people that are aghast with that, and to include his wife, right, you know, I don't know that you should be saying that. You know, it's like, and you'll hear coming up him talk about the things that he saw, what was done to the bodies of Marines that were killed, that the Japanese got their hands on. And so you'll get a little peek behind the curtain about why he did that. So interesting little piece of history too.
I've seen Marines tied up to a tree and used for bayonet practice. I've seen them, their heads cut off. I've seen them, their testicles cut out, penis cut off. Do just about anything that you could possibly think of, the Japs would do that. I've seen them use a bayonet on people, maybe 50 or 60 bayonet thrusters through the guy, and for any one of the first one that killed him, and he just keeps going, you know, and keeps, I guess they all took turn or whatever. I don't know what the hell they are called of, but they're a brutal enemy, and sadistical enemy. They just have no feeling for anything or anybody, and they were on the attack that wouldn't surrender, and they fought until death, and I tried to accommodate as many of them as I could while I was out there. They wanted to die for the emperor. I tried to help them along with that. Captain Halladane was one of the best commanders of the company of COs that I ever served under.
This is their commanding officer, Andrew Akak Haldane, and he was killed by a sniper on Peleliu.
He was a compassionate man. He was strict. He never raised his voice. I never heard him raise his voice, not one time to anybody. But he had the respect of every man in that company. He walked like he was the man, and you showed respect to him as same as you would anybody. And he demanded that, and he was a leader of Marines. He was captain of Marines, and that's exactly what he was. Captain Halladane, whenever we'd go out on, get into a firefight or get into moving forward, Captain Halladane led us. He didn't get behind us. He led his troops. And I guess that's the reason he got killed, because he was looking over the ridge to see what was going on the other side whenever he got shot. But he was an outstanding Marine as far as I'm concerned. He was an outstanding leader of the Marines. Not only to the Marines of the rank and file, he was the same way with his officers that served under him. They respected him same as we did. Thought he was good. It was a jungle warfare. It rained a lot, and we had war dogs, and the war dogs, we'd go out on patrol.
Now, this is him talking about fighting on Cape Gloucester again.
And the war dog would spot the Japs for us, and we knew they were there. Couldn't see them, but we knew they were there. And we'd look them out, find them. And most of the time, they'd be in a lean-to made out of coconut palms and just lounging around inside of that thing. And we captured three of them one time and took them into the battalion headquarters. And we'd been out there for maybe 30 days or so, still wearing the same socks, same shoes, same underwear, same everything. We brought the Japs in, and they gave them new socks, new shoes, new underwear, new dungarees, new cap. And we thought, the hell with that. We bring them in, and they get fitted up with new clothes, and we don't get anything. So we took care of that. We didn't bring any more in. Peleliu ranged in temperatures anywhere from 100 to 120 degrees. It never did get below 100 at night, I don't believe. I know the coral rock was still hot. It never cooled off. And the first day, we went ashore with two canteens. That's 2 quarts of water. And it was so hot, and it was just absolutely, it was, you wouldn't believe how hot it was. And a lot of the men that drank their water quicker than they should have, they should have tapered it off, but they didn't. And that next morning we got some canteens, not canteens, but 5-gallon cans of water that they had brought ashore. But they were cans that they had stored gasoline and oil in, and they hadn't been properly washed out. And they tasted like gasoline or oil, whichever, however lucky you was to get it to you, had a drink of water that tasted like gasoline, or you had one that tasted like oil. And people couldn't drink it. The ones that did got sick to their stomach. And we found a little shallow well about 10 or 12 foot deep. And one of the guys jumped off down in there, and he was filling canteens up and handing them back out. And the guys that drank that, some of them got sick off of drinking that water. It was kind of murky looking, white, milky looking water. And some of them got sick from drinking that. And it was, I don't know how long it was before we got any water that was good water. And I've been hungry and I've been thirsty, and I'll take hunger any day over thirst. Thirsty, you can get panicky if you don't have enough water for a period of time. You can get panicky on that. Hillbilly Jones was one of the best officers.
Says the platoon commander, weapons platoon, by the name of Hillbilly Jones.
In charge of platoons and men that I've ever known. He was the strictest Marine officer that I've ever served under. But he didn't make up his rules as he come out for inspection every morning. He went by the book, and he went by the book every day on everything. And when you'd come out for a roll call in the morning, he wanted that top button on your dungaree jacket. He wanted your cuffs buttoned. He wanted you standing erect. He wanted you to be a Marine. He said, you don't give a damn where you're in the Pacific, Europe, or wherever you're at. You're a Marine. You're going to act like a Marine. And if you don't, I'm going to make you look like a Marine. I think Hillbilly had about 4 years, and I think he had 8 years seagoing Marine. And you've got to be sharp to be a seagoing Marine. They don't take the slobs, they take the best. And he was real strict when we were on duty. 4 o'clock came and they turned us loose. It wouldn't be long. You see Hillbilly coming down the street with his guitar across her shoulder, and he'd come down and sit in the tent with you. Only officer I ever knew to do that. Come down, sit down there, and we'd sing songs or maybe 10 o'clock that night, you know. He was a really good guy. Just down to earth, good man. And he also got a Silver Star on Guadalcanal. And he also was promoted from, he got a field commission. He didn't go to OCS. They promoted him in the field. So that shows you he had something. I joined the Marine Corps because I thought it was an elite outfit. And I liked their uniforms. They looked sharp. And I always thought the Army kind of looked sloppy in their uniforms. I did not want to be a dog face. That's what they called them back when I was a kid growing up. They always called the Army dog face. Now, I wouldn't have mind going into the Navy, but preferably the Marine Corps. So that's the way I went whenever I got ready to come in.
How funny is that? People still join because of the uniforms. But, hey, Marine Corps got good-looking uniforms. Everybody knows it. All right, now this is something I found that kind of, I know it is kind of loud at the start, but it starts with, it's his silver star. I'm sorry, it's his bronze star, kind of him narrating what happened in the action that led to his bronze star.
May 1st, day 31. The 5th Marines arrive at the Shuri Line to relieve the battered 27th Army Infantry Division. With the Marines is Sergeant R.V. Bergen.
On May the 2nd, we started to move out, and the machine gun opened up. They killed a couple of three of our men and wounded them. I was with some of those Marines out there for 2.5 years. And whenever somebody get hit, it's just like your family. That's when I decided that he needed knocking out, and needed knocking out right quick. Like.
The Japanese machine gunner is completely hidden. Up against such tactics, Bergen resorts to desperate measures to break the stalemate.
I knew which way he was coming from. Didn't know exactly where he was at, but I knew he was right there in that area. So I got a bright idea. If I walked around there, I could see the fire coming out of the motor hole at machine gun.
To the disbelief of his fellow Marines, Bergen slowly edges out of cover, making himself a target for the machine gun. He's hoping to spot the muzzle flare of the gun, giving away his position. He's banking on the Japanese machine gunner missing him on the first shot.
So that was the strategy. The strategy is, I'm going to go out and expose myself. He's not going to hit me with his first rounds. And, all right. Whose idea is this? Who thinks this is a good idea? Bergen better believe it's a good idea because it's his idea.
Sure enough, he opened up on me. He put 2 bullet holes in my right dungaree between my knee and ankle, and 3 bullet holes in my left dungaree. He was very close, but I saw the fire. I knew exactly where he was set up.
Dungarees. Through my dungarees. Let me decode that if you don't understand. But like, that's through his pant leg, right? Or his blouse, right? Or his blouse. One of the two. They went through his clothes, okay? Yeah, amazing.
He was in some bushes. I guess he thought he had the world by the tail, but he was mistaken.
Bergen calls in the coordinates for a mortar strike.
I was pretty darn good with the distance. Approximately 300 yards or 600 yards, and I just knew. Fired one round. I made an adjustment. I got a direct hit with the second round. Machine gun went forward and the Jap went backwards. We didn't have any trouble then going across the valley.
Bergen is awarded the Bronze Star for his selfless actions.
Some people told me I was brave by doing that. After I thought about it, I said, pretty damn stupid, too.
I think it gives you some idea of how pissed off he was, though, that somebody in Kilo Company, probably in weapons platoon, had been killed. So it gives you some sense of him. I want to play one more piece of audio. This is about 19 minutes long. But this is him speaking at an event, and he'll talk about some similar things. But, again, this is Sergeant R.V. Bergen, who wrote a book The book's entitled Islands of the Damned, Marines in the Pacific. And so he's featured in the series Pacific. But, you know, it's just a plain-spoken Marine from Texas who answered his nation's call. And then after the war was an articulate spokesman for fellow Marines. So this is him in his own words speaking, and it doesn't give too much information about the event, but he's speaking from a podium, and so here he is in his own words. R.V. Bergen, Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, member of Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines.
Good morning. I joined the Marine Corps on November the 13th, 1942, and I went through boot camp at San Diego. And on March the 12th, we were headed for the Pacific. We went to Australia, and I joined up with the 1st Marine Division that had just came off of Guadalcanal. I give those Guadalcanal veterans credit today for saving my life, because I listened to the stories that they told. I asked questions. I wanted to know every single thing that I could know about what the Japs did, what we did, and how it all took place. So I had about almost 9 months before I actually went into combat. My first combat was New Britain. We hit New Britain on December the 26th, and we left there on May the 4th. And we were there in the monsoon season. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained some more. You could wake up in the middle of the night and dip water out of your foxhole with your helmet. We stayed wet, I don't know how long. I never stayed wet as long at one time in my life as I did on New Britain. My two little toenails rotted completely off and stayed wet so long. Malaria was, and dysentery was, all over the place there in that jungle. We had one hell of a battle on Suicide Creek, and we lost a lot of men. And then our next real battle on New Britain was Hill. So it had a number, but I can't remember the number. We fought all afternoon or all day to take that ridge. And when we got to the top of the ridge, we didn't back off. And that night, we had 5 banzai charges between 1 o'clock and daylight. And the next morning, you could literally walk on the Japanese without stepping on the ground. That's how many we racked up in front of us with their banzai charges. We had other instances on that deal. We went up to, went aboard some type of vessel and went around to Talisea Peninsula and anchored at, went ashore at Talisea. And then we went on what's supposed to have been a 3-day patrol up towards New Munda. And it wound up being 10 days. And the Japanese would ambush us and throw knee mortars and rifles, machine guns. And then they'd, if we didn't get them, they'd pull back and set up, and we'd go through the same thing in a few hours or the next day. And anyway, that we went up about 10 or 15 miles from Talisea on that patrol. And then we came back to Talisea and set up. And while we were sitting there, the story that he told about the food reminded me of where we were set up. We had soup once a day, and it was so thin that you could put a newspaper in the bottom of the bowl and read it through the soup. We lost a lot of weight just because we didn't have anything to eat. So they finally came and got us and took us to Pavuvu in the Russell Islands. Well, the first time around at Pavuvu, we didn't have electricity and only had running water in the showers and the galley. And we had mud streets, and it rained a lot, and our streets were always muddy. You could fall out in the morning for roll call, and you'd be standing in ankle-deep mud, and your cots, the ground was so wet, your cots would sink into the ground, and you just actually was laying on the ground and with these canvas on the cot between you and in the ground. We went from there, we went to Peleliu, and while we were gone to Peleliu, they did a lot of work on that camp. They rocked the streets, and they got electricity and running water in several places. And we stayed there. We left Peleliu on September the 26th in 1944. And we came back to Pavuvu right before we had gone left from. And on April the 1st then, we hit Okinawa. And Okinawa was the largest invasion in World War II. I saw more dogfights, airplanes fighting one another, airplanes and their fighter planes going at it. That's the only place in the Pacific that I did see that, because all the other places that I was, it was so wooded, the timber was so thick you couldn't see up in the sky. That's what was going on up there. So I saw our fighter planes and their fighter planes going at it. And sometimes they would get so high that you couldn't tell which plane was which. And one of them would be knocked down out of the sky, and you would just hope it was theirs. You didn't know that it was, but you were hoping that it was their plane knocked down. Okinawa had four divisions on it. The 6th Marine Division took the west coast. We tied in with them. 2 Army divisions was on our left, and we hit the island about midway of the island and went south. And Okinawa was one of the largest battles in the Pacific. No other island had 4 divisions on it. We took us from April the 1st to June the 26th to secure it. I got hit with shrapnel on the 20th day of May and spent 20 days in the hospital. And when I got out of the hospital, I came right back and picked up right where I left off and finished it up. And I finally left Okinawa in October. In September, the division went to China, but I stayed on the island and was waiting on transportation to come back to the States. And I finally got a ride on the ship out on the 16th of October. And on the way home, we we were out about 4 or 5 days and ran into a typhoon. And they said that the waves on the typhoon was 50 foot, and I believe every word of it. I know that ship would go up and come down, go up and come down. And one night I was pulling guard duty till 12 o'clock. And I got off at 12 and I came back and laid down on my bunk. And about the time I laid down, all hell broke loose. The kitchen stoves broke loose from the bulkhead and the sliding across the floor and hitting the other wall. And the canteens and the mess kits that we had up on the I-beams, they were falling off and hitting the concrete floor. And everybody, the lights came on and everybody sat up in their bunks. Part of them stood up. And I thought, this is the heck of a note. I go through what I've gone through, 3 battles, and then I drowned on the way home. But anyway, I thought, well, I'll see if we're still floating. So I laid down flat on my back and I felt the ship go up, come down. Go up, come down. Did that 3 or 4 times. I thought, well, we're still floating. I turned over and went to sleep. Anyway, I made it home, and I was discharged from the Marine Corps on November the 24th, 1945. Joined on November the 13th, 1942, and I was discharged on November the 24th, 1945. 3 years and 11 days that I spent in there. And my battles were New Britain, Peleliu, and Okinawa. The Peleliu was, as far as I'm concerned, was the worst battle that I was in. It was a coral island. It was 2 miles wide and 6 miles long. And had over 11,000 Japs on it. And over 500 caves. And we had to dig them out of those caves, one cave at a time. And there was a little island about 500 or 600 yards off of the coast of Peleliu that was called Nikosivas. And on September, we hit Peleliu on September the 15th, 1944. And on September the 28th, the 3rd Battalion got aboard Amtrak's and went across the bay and hit Nikosivas. It had an airstrip on it. And the Corsairs were giving us air support. And I still like that Corsair today better than I do any plane that's ever been manufactured. They saved our bacon many times, those Corsairs did. They were bombing, and the Corsairs were bombing and strafing, and we hit the beach on Nikosivas. And that was on September the 28th, and September the 29th, we late that afternoon on September the 29th, 2 days later, we were headed back to Peleliu. We had that island secured. We killed over 500 Japs on that island. And in the movie, The Pacific, it shows one of our deals at the bunker. We were sitting on the mortars, with 60 mortars up right close to that bunker. And Sledge, one of my men, said, "Bergen, there's Japs in that bunker." And I said, "Sledge, you must be cracking up. Our first sergeant said that the bunker was clear." He said, "I don't give a damn what Saunders said. There's Japs in there. I hear them jabbering." So I eased up, and they had vents. They had 2 entrances to the bunker, and the bunker would hold about 15 to 20 Japs, and had 2 entrances, and they had vents on the side of the bunkers. They were concrete bunkers, about reinforced with steel, about a foot wide, a foot thick, and I eased up to one of those vents and looked down, and a Japanese had his face stuck right up in it. And I took my 45 and did away with him right quick, and then I grabbed my rifle and stuck it down between the bars on the vent and emptied the clip, reloaded, and did that again. And it was just like kicking a beehive. They came alive in there. I didn't know how many there was in there, but I knew there was a bunch. So we messed around there for quite some time. I don't know where my lieutenant was. He had a way of disappearing whenever the going got tough. But my sergeant, him and Tom Matheny, the other squad leader, was running the sound-powered phone line up to the front, which was about 30 or 40 yards in front of us. So I was the only NCO there. So we messed around there with those chaps in that bunker for a few minutes, and they had a machine gun, rifles, and throwing grenades out. And I thought, I better do something with this because I'm going to get somebody killed or hurt seriously. So I ran down to the beach, which was about 200 yards, and got an Amtrak with a 75 Hauser on it and brought him back and showed him, told him what I wanted him to do. I wanted him to knock a hole in that side of that bunker. And it took him about four rounds of that 75 Hauser to put a hole in there with about 20, 24 inches in diameter. And then Charles Womack, he was our flamethrower, with a flamethrower on his back, and he came up and scorched him. And there were 17 Japs in that bunker. I can't remember where we killed 10 outside that tried to escape or 10 inside, but there was either killed 7 outside or 10 inside. But anyway, there were 17 of them. And I thought, after it was all over, I thought, well, did pretty good. We killed 17 Japs, and I didn't get a man hurt. So that was a pretty good operation. We stayed on that island until the next afternoon, and then we came right back to Peleliu. Most people never heard of Peleliu, but the 1st Marine Division had 6,526 casualties in 30 days. The 81st Wildcat Division, the Army relieved us on October the 15th, and they had over 250 killed and over 1,250 wounded after we left. So that made that little 2x6 mile island with over 8,000 casualties, and not very many people ever heard of Peleliu. But that just shows you that things went on out there that the public back in the stateside didn't know about. After Peleliu, we went back to the Russell Islands at Pavuvu, and our guys that had fought on Guadalcanal, New Britain, and Peleliu, they were rotated home. And the men that we had lost, we had 60% casualties on Peleliu. And the men that were rotated home and the casualties that we had, our company was pretty thin. And we got replacements from the States and built our company back up to about around 235 before we hit Okinawa. And we hit Okinawa on April the 1st. And Okinawa was from April the 1st to June the 26th. And after Okinawa, the division went to China, and I went to the south end of the island around Naha area, the airport, and waited transportation to come home. And I left Okinawa on October the 16th and came home and was discharged on November the 24th. And lived happy ever after. Thank you.
And lived happily ever after. So it's I had watched that stuff yesterday and wanted to share it with you today. It's you know, those guys have always been my heroes. They came back And they, you know, they went to work. And honestly, it's their stories that I've tried to tell over the course of the last couple of years that have, that are the kind of the bedrock of post-traumatic winning. And so as I listened to that stuff yesterday after I got off the air, I thought, you know what, I need to do this. I need to share this stuff because it's so good. And I mean, you can hear the pain in his voice. You can hear the detail that he talks in. You know, he happens, you know, he goes through that stuff in his 20s, right? And he's still talking about it in his 90s. So that's how vivid, and that's how instrumental, right, the event is in your life. And so, I thought it was very cool stuff, and the way, just a soft-spoken, articulate Texan, and the book that he wrote is entitled Islands Plural of the Damned, A Marine at War in the Pacific. And he wrote it with a guy named Bill Marvel. So and it again says it was published in 2010. So I don't know if somebody got in touch with him and how that whole excuse me, how that whole thing happened. I'm going to have to do a little research about it, though, because I'm not content that not to know that. So with all that said, that'll do it on a Tuesday. If you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. Going to see if Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny will join me tomorrow. And then I think on Monday you're going to hear from a series of Marines and get their thoughts on post-traumatic winning. So, yeah, excited to do that. And then working on another battle study. That's right. So, to update a story that we talked about at the top of the news about how crazy the world is, a senior, a girl who was evidently infatuated with the Columbine killings, who went to Denver, purchased a shotgun, is now dead. I haven't seen anything that says how she died. Denver schools were not in session today because of the threat she made, and so, our crazy world, right? Our crazy world. But, you know, the people that need to be protected are safer. I don't, again, there's been no, I've not seen anything that says how she lost her life, whether it was at her own hands or at the hands of somebody else. There's been no word from that yet on any news source that I've seen, so. It's a better outcome than innocent people being killed. So life sucks sometimes. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. You know, clearly people that are disturbed, and I dare say as this story blossoms, that what we're going to see is, you know, a long line of things that we've already seen. And what is that? Somebody who had a troubled history relative to mental health, but, you know, they've got their right. They haven't broken the law just because they're crazy and making threats. So, a sad outcome, but, you know, it's a better outcome than innocent people being killed. All right, with that said, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow on a Wednesday, All Marine Radio. Over and out.